Welcome to Nancy's Bookshelf, a weekly program of conversations with North State and national writers from North State Public Radio. Now here's your host, Nancy Wickman.
My guest today is best known as the narrator voice of 11 Ken Burns documentaries, but Peter Coyote has also been an actor, improv teacher, award-winning poet, musician and songwriter, political activist, administrator and advocate for the arts, longtime Buddhist meditator, and now Buddhist priest. Peter Coyote has won 2 Emmys and written several books. His most recent is A Guide to Zen Buddhism that combines his activism with his Buddhist teaching, which he calls Vernacular Zen. This teaching was originally lectures given on Facebook during the COVID pandemic. So, Peter Coyote, welcome.
Hi, Nancy. Thanks. It's something like 14 Ken Burns now.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Time has gone on. I always say to those kind of florid and flattering introductions, you forgot to mention how they found me in bulrushes.
Well, I have a couple of questions about the cover of your book, because there was something that surprised me. There's your picture there, you have on a shirt, and do you know what surprised me when I looked at your photograph?
The cell phone?
Yes. You have a cell phone in your pocket on the cover of your book.
Yeah. You know, here's the thing. I love this company, Inner Traditions, mm-hmm. and they published my previous book called The Lone Ranger and Tonto Meet the Buddha.
I remember.
Which was a really bastard child of a book. It didn't fit any category. And I could just see that I was going to be carrying it around in the trunk of my car. But the cover was so hideous that when we came up to do this book, their design team came up with another hideous cover. And we just went back and forth and back and forth. And I still don't know what this 4th of July thing coming out of the top of my head is that's looping over my shoulder. But I actually had this picture taken as a part of a series of publicity photos for something else, and my wife thought it was a good picture, so I just put it on, and I use a cell phone all the time, so the hell with it.
Well, it is a very nice photograph of you. Now, I did not mention the subtitle of your book. The title, Zen in the Vernacular, and I'm very happy that you wrote a book with that information, Zen in the Vernacular. But now, the subtitle sounds like bad grammar.
Yes, it does.
Things as it is.
You know, so when I first heard that phrase from the Japanese founder of my lineage, Suzuki Roshi, Sunryu Suzuki Roshi, who wrote the wonderful book Zen Mind, Beginner's Mind, which has sold over 1 million copies, I thought it was bad grammar. I thought it was like he was just not fluent in English. But the more I thought about it, it's a perfect expression of both of the simultaneous singular and holistic view of the world. Things is the plural of reality as we know it. You're over there, I'm over here, there's a tree, there's a bird, there's a lake. But all of this is part of one greater whole, and that's the it. So there was actually a kind of method to his expression, which is very accurate, and that's why I used it. Things as it is, the plural, the apparently separate, and the whole thing exists simultaneously. And depending on which one we're looking at, gives us our sense of the universe.
My guest is Peter Coyote, and his new book is Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. Now, people might wonder, you weren't born in California, so how did you and when did you get involved with Zen Buddhism? In answer to that question, why don't you read us from your book?
This is
from your introduction to part 2, Infusing the Ordinary.
Sure. The first paragraph or the first
yes,
two?
Yes, the first paragraph.
Okay. At the time of my arrival at San Francisco Zen Center in 1974, several years after Suzuki Roshi's death, the elaborate formal Zen aesthetics brought to San Francisco by the Japanese teachers Suzuki Roshi had invited were a welcome balm to my wounded body, barely clean of drugs. My spirit was also wounded by a decade in the disordered wilds of the counterculture and communal life. Frequent use of heroin and the helter-skelter turmoil of the streets' freefall communes. The assassination of Black leaders and multiplying burdens of unregulated capitalism were stressing the fabric of daily life. While a part of me still longed for the ecstasies of counterculture freedom, the discipline and order of Zen was indisputably calming my sense of despair, personally and politically, and restoring me to health.
You know, Peter, I think some people, if they don't know your background, will be shocked at what you wrote in that paragraph, because we think of you now perhaps as a paragon of perfection, and that's not...
Well, you've never spoken to my ex-wives, Nancy.
Well, I'm going to ask you to skip a couple of paragraphs and continue reading one more paragraph there in your book.
Okay. As I relaxed and accepted the practices of Zen Center, my understanding of how the prescribed forms of sitting, standing, walking, and bowing evolved. And as it did, my resistance diminished. Clearly, they were not punishments designed to force my freedom-loving American spirit into compliance. They proved useful in helping me express and self-critique the development of my practice, and became a gateway into understanding the utility of discipline generally.
If you recognize that voice, it's the voice of narrator Peter Coyote. He narrated 14 Ken Burns documentaries. Now, you give us the year when you first walked into the Zen Center in or San Francisco Zen Center in 1974. And the reason I noticed that year is that this was before you were an actor in the movie E.T. Is that correct?
Oh, well before. Yeah. So let just the 5 minute cram is that I was in the counterculture for about 10 years. I was in a radical theater group that evolved into a group called the Diggers, who fed 600 people a day in the Haight-Ashbury and started the first free medical clinic. And we were trying to imagine a world we wanted to live in and make it real by acting it out. And then that evolved into a series of communal experiments based on poverty, but based also on the fact that, you know, one big refrigerator could serve far more than a nuclear family, ditto for a stove. So we were trying to figure out how America was going to make it into the future without bankrupting the planet or extracting everything from it. So all those were noble experiments, but we also brought all of our problems and unresolved issues with us. And one of mine was from a lot of violence in my childhood and a lot of unresolved anger, which I kept sedated with heroin. I had a junkyard dog in my psyche that was just chained tight. And by the time I came back to San Francisco, my daughter's mother had run away, left me with my daughter. I was a single father. My dad had died well below broke in a sort of catastrophe that wiped him out. And everything I had calculated on in the last 10 years had just fallen apart. And my health was not in good shape, and I needed to make some kind of radical change in my life. And luckily, I began dating a woman I later married and had a child with, who was a very serious Zen student. And she got me introduced to Zen Center and got me started on a kind of disciplined meditation course. And although I hated it when I first started, it gradually won me over, and I'm in my 50th year. And I'm now what they call a transmitted teacher, which means that my teacher stuck a meat thermometer in me and said, "You're done, and you can go on and ordain your own priest."
To your surprise, because you didn't think you were ready.
So. My surprise, yeah, exactly.
Well, the reason I mentioned E.T. is... and the fact that you had been practicing Buddhism when you were in that movie, just at the end. And somebody who saw this movie as a child said he remembered that all the adults in that movie were not sympathetic characters until you appeared toward the end of the movie. And he said your presence was so soothing. And so he is, in other words, he was wondering, maybe Buddhism played a role in your character being so sympathetic in that movie.
Well, that's an interesting observation, and I'll tell you a story that's not widely known about it. First of all, I became an actor because I was flat broke, but I'd had a big success running the State Arts Council for Jerry Brown. And to do that, I'd had to learn how to make friends with Republicans and conservatives and all sorts of different people. And it gave me permission to see myself as not just a denizen of the counterculture anymore. And it gave me the courage to say, well, I'm going to try the movies. I'll give myself 5 years. If it doesn't work out, I'll do something else. But I didn't want to write for money. Writing is kind of sacred to me, but I had certain amount of skill as an actor and I thought I'd go for it. And I got very, very lucky. Well, in the making of that movie, Steven Spielberg was not yet Steven Spielberg. Uh-huh. This was his little personal film, and he had seen me in a film called Southern Comfort. But somewhere in the film, I went to him and I said, Steven, I'm afraid that we are going to be discrediting both science and adults unless we craft a scene where you see that this guy you've been using as the heavy with the keys chasing E.T. is actually kind of like a grown-up Elliot. And he let me write that scene in the hospital where I say, you know, Elliot, I'm so glad he came to you first. I always wanted to do this and see this. And so my task was to redeem both adults and science in that particular little universe of the film.
It just gives me chills when you describe that, Peter. Thank you.
Well, think of the generosity of a director as famous
yes.
as to let, you know, a Jew with an animal name come into his thing and write a piece of the story. And mm-hmm. it's true, I did two drafts, and Melissa Matheson, the screenwriter, she did a polish on it, but it's basically like I wrote it.
Do you know, that reminds me of the part of your book where you talk about intuition and saying that, so I'm thinking maybe Steven Spielberg was following his intuition. You say in your book, intuition is directly related to our success as a species and often will help us understand complex situations more readily than logic. So logically, this director would have said, no, I'm not going to let you do that. But Steven Spielberg, I'm a big fan of his and he's so talented. And so that's probably his intuition said, you know, I think this is a good idea, Peter.
But, you know, one of the things that we introduced in the State Arts Council was the creative process. We knew that if we tried to just give grants to artists, that conservatives would resist that and they wouldn't like it. We'd be wrapped up in fighting. But what we realized is that all artists operate in kind of the same way. And we called it the creative process. They get a hunch or an idea. They express it as a line of writing, a splash of color, a movement. And then they step back and they evaluate it with their intellect. And they see, oh, what's the next step? What's the logical next step? And by going backwards and forwards between intuition and logic, they are continually doing creative problem solving. And so we got the state to hire artists to go to work for various agencies, schools, prisons, senior citizens, let dancers work with seniors who were having movement problems. We taught in the prisons, we taught skills to non-literate people. We had students crafting films about teenage pregnancy. And they all came from this combination of intuition and logic. And so Stephen is, if anything, he's an artist. And you know that he's as in touch with his intuitions as he is with his logical facilities. So I was not, I never even questioned it. I just thought I was not trying to advance my position in the film. This is what the story needed. And I think he saw that too.
Well, you say in your book that Buddhism is a very intuitive practice. And it sounds like that's what you were following your intuition in making that suggestion to Steven Spielberg.
Well, let me explain why. So intuition is lights up much larger areas of the brain than logic or math or any of those things. It's a combination of memory, emotion, and intelligence. And so from the first time a little monkey heard something in the bushes and dropped its nut and scurried up a tree, and it wasn't a lion, it was another monkey that come and took its nut. We began developing these facilities of like sending our intelligence and our feelings out to assess situations. And the universe is so impossibly complex that there's no way that you can steer your way through it by logic. But since we're actually made of that universe, we can, through meditation or just being quiet, we can access that energy within us, and our intuitions will actually guide us pretty accurately in most cases.
In fact, you say intuition is a far more ancient aspect of mind. You make that point in your book.
Yeah, it is.
Let me remind people, the title of your book, Zen in the Vernacular, and the author is Peter Coyote. We'll be back to continue our conversation after a short break. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wiegman. I'm Nancy Wiegman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. My guest today is Peter Coyote, and his book is Zen in the Vernacular, A Guide to Zen Buddhism. I am glad you wrote a book, Zen in the Vernacular, because there's so many of them that I think the average person has trouble understanding all these terminology. So, where did you get this idea to write a book on the vernacular of Zen?
So when I was at Zen Center, I told you how impressed I was with the aesthetics and the kind of beauty of Japanese culture. But as I stayed longer, I stayed there 8 years, I began to be concerned that it was going to appear as always foreign to Americans, that they were not going to shave their heads, they were not going to wear black robes, and that actually Buddha wasn't Japanese. Buddha was Nepali. And that in every country that Buddhism went to, they assumed gift wrapping of the culture they were entering to try to lubricate its passage into that culture. So we were accepting this Japanese form wholeheartedly, and people were taking Japanese names and wearing Japanese clothes and doing all this stuff. But there are some problems from an American point of view with Japanese culture. It tends to be quite hierarchical, and it tends to be quite authoritarian in terms of masters and disciples. And that played into some aspects about American culture that really bothered me. And I thought, we take these vows to save all beings, and the Japanese gift wrapping may not be explaining Buddha's gift to people in language and terms that they can understand. So that's what I took on in writing this book. I wanted to loosen the Japanese gift wrapping and try to explain the states and the teachings of the Buddha in ways that would make sense to Americans, because it's not exactly a religion. Buddha was a normal man, that's stressed over and over again. And he solved the problem of believing that we have a separate self, which is separated from the rest of the universe, which creates most of our problems, and taught us about what a human being actually is. A human being is a piece of the universe, and we're half positive and we're half negative. And it's that half negative that makes us watch ourselves. Because if we just think we're the good guys, we're going to wind up bombing a hotel in Baghdad in the middle of the night, killing men, women, and children, because we've already decided that everything we do is good. But if we understand that we're fully human beings and that we have everything from Hitler to Jesus inside of us, well, then it's our job to monitor what's coming up and not let the negative aspects of it get past our teeth or get locked into our muscles to do something. And that makes you far more sensitive and cautious in the way that you move through the world. So I worried about that aspect of Japanese. And then during COVID, when I was doing weekly Dharma talks, I was just talking colloquially to Americans, and they seemed to really like it and find comfort in it. And because I was shooting from the hip, we had recorded all those lectures, and I thought, well, hell, I'm gonna relook at them and make sure I didn't say anything too stupid and make myself a little smarter than I might have been. And that's what became this book.
My guest is author and narrator of documentaries, Peter Coyote, and his book is Zen in the Vernacular. Now, you mentioned this, you call it gift wrapping, that here we are adopting these practices from Japan. And you mentioned in one of the paragraphs you read, you said, as I relaxed and accepted the practices of Zen Center, my understanding of how the prescribed forms of sitting, standing, walking, and bowing evolved. Now, people are going to say, what, Peter, I ain't going to bow to some statue of Buddha. How can you justify that bowing stuff? You said it's not a religion.
Yes, it's not.
Buddha's not a god.
He's not a god. He was a person. And what we're bowing to when we bow is the wisdom of his teachings and our own wisdom, because there's no difference between Buddha's inner state and our inner state. Buddha nature is like the essential precursor energy of the universe. You think of it like a pregnant energy, which is continually evolving into forms. Mosquitoes, dogs, rabbits, birds, trees, fields, mountains, rivers, lakes, oceans. Coming up into existence for a while. The best way I can clarify it is, imagine you're standing on a cliff overlooking an ocean full of choppy waves, not big rollers, but little peaks coming, rising and falling. Well, each of those little waves could be a nameable thing in the universe. Could be a person, could be a species, could be an animal, could be a tree. And they come up out of the formlessness of the ocean, and they appear as form for a while, and then they go back into the ocean. And when it's a little peaked wave, we call it living. And when it goes back into the ocean, we call it dying. But what we forget, and what those little wavelets forget, is that they've never not been part of the ocean, not for an instant. My life has never been separate from oxygen, from sunlight, from water, from microbes in the soil that grow my food, from the people growing the cotton, weaving it into cloth, cutting it into clothes, shipping it to me, building my car, building my computer. We're all like ticks on the body of a dog. It's one big thing. And that's an essential half of the equation. So if you just think that you're alone, it's frightening. You know, it's terrifying to be so immaterial in the face of the immensity of the universe. But when you also realize that you're absolutely a part of it, it's not like oxygen exists to keep your little separate self alive. It's that your life is oxygen. Your life is sunlight. It's like having all these little umbilical cords connected to everything in the world. So when we bow, we're bowing in gratitude for that knowledge. And we're also bowing to our own Buddha nature, because that thing we refer to as I and me and mine and stuff, that is just an awareness. There's no fixed thing in there that is like an armature in a sculpture holding it up. There's no little person behind my forehead doing my seeing, hearing, thinking, feeling. And once you realize that it's an awareness, if there's something that you don't like about yourself or that you feel needs work, you can see it's not cast in stone. And with effort and practice, you can overcome it. And that our natural state is a kind of freedom that's too immense to even fully understand.
Well, now this term that you used a couple of times now, Buddha nature, comes up so many times in your book. So if you're telling somebody who doesn't understand Buddhism, in a nutshell, what would you, how would you explain to them the importance or even the definition of Buddha nature?
Well, just imagine that there's a pregnant energy in the universe that you can't see. It has no shape, color, sound. I mean, this is what physicists are aiming at when they're talking about string theory, or they're trying to examine what's the substrate of the universe, what's behind everything we see. Well, Buddhists call that formless energy emptiness, because it's empty of any particular characteristics. It can become anything. So Buddha nature is the fundamental nature of the universe, which is expressing itself all the time as forms. So everything you see yourself in the mirror is a form, but you are an expression of the nature of the universe. We call it Buddha nature, because if everything is connected to everything else, if I can't exist without sunlight, oxygen, water, etc., we say that I'm empty of a fixed self. Not that I don't exist, but that my self is an awareness, that it's fluid, that it's connected to all these other things. So what that, all this other thing, the energy that made all these other things is what we call Buddha nature.
My guest is Peter Coyote, and I'm asking him about his latest book, Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is. And I mentioned this Buddha nature, this term comes up often in your book. There's another term that comes up, and I had a friend, a Buddhist friend, who named her dog Bodhi. And you know what that was short for?
Sure, Bodhisattva.
So would you explain that to listeners?
Sure. A Bodhisattva is a technical term for someone who lives to serve others. And it's a kind of byproduct. When you meditate deeply enough and long enough, you may find that that self that you thought was so reliable may disappear for a few minutes. And you will see the universe without the intermediation of a self, which means your likes, your dislikes, what you're neutral about. You will just have an experience. That's what they call kensho, or awakening, or enlightenment. And when you see that, it generates a kind of love for creation that is kind of overpowering. You see that everything is really sacred and magical and inexplicable. A little housefly cleaning its face with its little wings on the tip of your finger is a miracle nobody can explain. And so bodhisattvas are people who express that love for the universe over and over again. And they're people who are so serious about it that they vow to withhold their own enlightenment until the last human is enlightened. So they're not in competition. They're not struggling to be the best and the brightest. They want to serve. And that's what a bodhisattva is.
Now, there's another term that comes up often in your book, and it's Sanskrit. And I particularly like this idea, even though my group that gets together, we don't call ourselves a sangha, but that's really what it is. And these are fellow practitioners, and I and my fellow practitioners get together, and it's not Zen meditation that we practice. It's not Zazen, but they are so important to my own practice. And I've even heard that, for example, when people want a resolution, they say, oh, I'm going to exercise three times a week. And they say that people who have a partner with them committed to practicing are more successful in exercise program or diet, whatever it is. So would you elaborate on the value of a sangha?
Sure. Again, this is one of these words that's a Sanskrit word, but it's so handy It's shorter to say than practitioners, but it's a group of beings that are together, unified in trying to explore spiritual truths and trying to get to the deepest understanding that they can of how the world works, and are dedicated to helping one another, to giving one another straight feedback, not prevaricating, not lying, not soft peddling, just being truthful with one another. And so that's what a Sangha is. It's they're followers of the path that you're on. And that doesn't necessarily have to be a Buddhist term. It is, so that's how we use it. It's a Sanskrit term, not a Japanese term, but it's useful.
Well, because I've studied Sanskrit, I really am interested when you would talk about words and translations of words, because I'm always wondering, was that a really good translation? And you do bring up that point. But before we leave this Buddhist Sangha, you make the point that a Buddhist Sangha doesn't require fealty to a particular mythology or much adherence to dogma. It is a wisdom tradition more than a religious tradition. And sometimes Buddhism is called a religion. And would you like to give us your point of view on that?
Sure. Well, the Buddhist position would be it is and it isn't a religion.
Yes.
There are people who practice Buddhism, aspects of Buddhism, like a religion. People who chant Nam-myoho Renge Kyo, for instance, which I would call a faith practice. You know, they dedicate themselves to reciting this thing, this phrase from the Lotus Sutra. So that's pretty typical religious practice, like reciting the mass. But Zen is a particularly stripped down investigation of the nature of the mind and the nature of reality. And it's probably closer to the way that Buddha actually spoke than a lot of the religious practices. But we have to remember there are millions and millions of people, and they're all different. And each one of those, or each group of those, will find their own understanding and their own way of practicing. And so the point is not to make anybody wrong. The Buddhist precepts, which, well, maybe they come closest to our Ten Commandments, there are guides for living an enlightened life. All Buddhists follow them. Not all Buddhists meditate. Not all Buddhists shave their heads. Not all Buddhists wear robes. Not all Buddhists marry. But all Buddhists follow the precepts and the edicts to do no harm and to be kind. So maybe I lost track of your question, Nancy.
Well, it was about the fact that that the Buddhist Sangha doesn't require you to believe any particular mythology.
Yes, it's just the precepts. You know, just, I mean, you can make your own Sangha. You can say, you know, we want to explore the words of Jesus. You just don't have to call it a Sangha, but it's, you could call it a study group. But a Sangha is a little deeper because it's a, it implies people who've dedicated their lives to this pursuit.
Well, this group that I participate with, my Sangha, since that's the label we're using, we don't have to talk. But if we have a newcomer, we do help the newcomer to join us. And in that regard, I ask a friend of mine here in Chico who practices Buddhism, going to Thich Nhat Hanh. So it's a Vietnamese version of Buddhism that he practices. And they get together Monday evenings. And I ask him, what do you do when a new person comes? And they do have somebody who is kind of, I guess you would say, in charge of starting the practice and ending the practice, which is what we do.
Sure, we do that too.
So I think you can welcome newcomers into your Sangha. And how do you do that?
Well, so my Sangha right now is kind of fixed because I'm training, let's say, six students, my last six students, to be teachers. And so it's such a cohesive group. We've been together so long that we're not actually introducing new members to the Sangha. But basically, you just invite someone to come and sit with you, and they listen to the people talking, and they feel it out, and they see if they like it. And if they keep showing up and keep sitting with you, eventually they become a Sangha member.
My guest is Peter Coyote, and his newest book is Zen in the Vernacular, and he's explaining some of these terms that we hear that Buddhists use. After a break, I will continue my conversation with Peter Coyote. You're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm Nancy Wigman. I'm Nancy Wigman, and you're listening to Nancy's Bookshelf on North State Public Radio. I'm back with my guest, award-winning actor, narrator, and Zen priest, Peter Coyote. His book is Zen in the Vernacular. You say that you don't even have to like somebody to bow and to treat somebody with respect. And I think I would find that hard to get along with
it's hard.
Somebody who didn't treat others with respect.
It's hard for me to realize that I'm made out of exactly the same stuff as Donald Trump.
Oh, gosh.
The universe made both of us. And, you know, he has as much right to be here and operate the way he wants to and accept the consequences of his actions. But I have no advantage over him by considering myself a good person. If I consider myself a good person, I'm ignoring all my shadows, or I'm putting them all on Donald Trump. And if I was raised with a father who was in the Ku Klux Klan and made his fortune by cheating people and taking advantage of them, I might be operating like Donald Trump. So when we meet people, it doesn't matter if we like them or not. That's our small mind. That's our personal ruler evaluating, well, I don't like people who do this. I don't like people who do this. I like people who do this, and I'm neutral about people who do that. All of that is your personal ruler. The universe is so far beyond that that you have to adjust to the way things actually are. It's not your universe. It's everybody's universe.
I think that's helpful advice. Even if people have no desire to become Buddhist, I think this is a way in just our daily life that's sound advice, Peter. Now, you also say that you do not treat your teachers like gurus. And I didn't think I would either, but I have a yoga practice that I've had for many years. And the person who introduced this particular style of yoga to the world, I didn't think he was a guru. But when I first practiced with him, I thought, my goodness, he is so skilled and he has a heart. And so when we would sit at his feet, say, to ask him questions, his English wasn't that proficient, but his answer to our questions so often was, do the practice and all is coming. If we do the practice, we'll get the answers that we are asking. And so I thought, now that, I like that advice, do the practice and all is coming. And I also liked your definition, I guess if I want to call it that, of faith. Because I have a problem with faith. I don't know about that. But you say it's a confidence developed from experience. Now, that I can go along with. If it's something, sure, I've experienced, for me, that is truth. I don't even have to believe it. I know I accept it as truth because it's a confidence developed from experience.
That's right. And Buddha told his followers quite explicitly, you know, even if people speak badly about me, don't get angry. Because it'll mess up your thinking. It'll mess up your clarity to be able to determine, is what they're saying true? So in Buddhism, in Zen anyway, we say, put no head above your own. You have my eyebrows tangle with Buddha's eyebrows. I see the world as Buddha sees the world. And I may be a little more obfuscated here and there than he was, but basically we're made of the same stuff. So there is a purpose to gurus, which is that they get you out of yourself. But there's also a shadow side, even in Zen. There are a lot of Zen masters who've had zipper trouble or alcohol trouble or bad relationship trouble. There's nobody that's completely reliable if they're not paying attention. A Zen master who's not paying attention is as big a fool as anybody else. So you have to always not give yourself away, your common sense, your sense of right and wrong. You can test it against a teacher, but if you're being pushed to do something that you feel is wrong, you have to defend that little piece of the universe because that's your turf to keep clean. And you don't want to let anybody, even another teacher, mess it up.
Well, you also make the point that Buddhists are not trying to improve reality. You say that's an important point, that Buddhists are not trying to improve reality.
Yeah. Reality is what it is. And the best thing you can do is see it clearly. We say, for instance, put your cow in a big field. Then you'll always know where it is. I lived on this commune once, and we had this cow chained to a little slope in the ground. And we were going out in the woods and picked mushrooms. And when we came back, the cow was dead. It had slipped off the mound and strangled in its chain. So if you put your cow in a big field and just watch it, you'll always know where it is when you need it. And it's the same with people. If you just watch people carefully, you'll know pretty soon what their intention is, what they're going to do, and how they're going to behave. And you can protect yourself accordingly. It's a different sense of control.
Yeah, because you say there's only one thing in the universe that we can control, and that is our intention.
That's right.
And
that's right.
I think you followed that with, I have a quote from the Dalai Lama that I just live by. He said, be kind whenever possible. It is always possible. And I think that's what you're saying, that our intention is the only thing in the universe that we can control is our own intention.
Well, you know, when I meet people, all I'm waiting for is for the nickel to drop and reveal to me what their fundamental intention is. Sometimes it's power, sometimes it's wealth, sometimes it's aggrandizement, sometimes it's being next to people who are powerful. But once I find it out, then I have an idea who they actually are. But I don't have to judge that intention. That intention is going to reap its own fruits on them. If it's negative or it doesn't have a heart or it's at odds with the universe, they'll pay for that. What I have to do is see it clearly so that I can behave accordingly.
Well, you suggest some questions toward the end of your book that we ask ourselves. And one point I don't think we've mentioned clearly is that a person does not have to change his or her previous religion to practice these ways that you're describing.
That's exactly right. The Dalai Lama said, my religion is kindness.
Yes.
And you don't have to. There's nothing about Buddhist practice. I've practiced with Catholic monks. Mm-hmm. I've practiced with Jews. I've practiced with Episcopalian ministers. There's nothing about meditation or Buddha's worldview that is inimical to any faith.
Yeah. Well, I mentioned that you have some questions for us. And the first question you suggest is, are we making a constant effort?
Yeah.
And then you say, the second question, that we should focus on our intention. We were just talking about intention. Focus on our intention consistently, moment after moment.
Yeah, we don't want to take holidays in our awareness. You know, a guy cuts us off with a car and we're ready to flip in the bird.
Oh, you mentioned that happening to yourself.
And when you think about that, that's not very far from pulling a trigger. So you want to be in a state of kind of limpid awareness. So when those things come up, they're not jerking your chain. You can just watch them. But it's also important to remember that those things are unbidden. They're not your fault. It's my dog. The affliction that happens to you, the guy cutting you off, and what arises from it is not your fault. It's not happening because you're not spiritually aware.
I think we're ready to have the third thing you mentioned along with these questions is about practicing kindness, which we mentioned, and practicing how to be helpful. Now, Peter, there was a chapter that I could barely get through. It was chapter 23 on loss.
Oh, no.
and you keep quoting, "and yet," and you say, "grief is the price we pay for loving and loss."
Yes, I believe that. So it's a very famous poem. There was a famous poet, one of the most famous poets in Japan, who just lived a very simple life. He was not a Buddhist priest. He just wrote poems. He belonged to the high church of haiku, he would joke. And when his second daughter died, he wrote this beautiful little poem that goes, "This dewdrop world is but a dewdrop world, and yet." And that "and yet" covers, yes, we know the world is transitory. We know that things are passing away. We know that everything we cherish and love will disappear. And yet, it doesn't protect us from grief, from sorrow, from all of these mental and physical events. And it's the running away from them that really ruins our lives. You know, if you think about like what addictions are a running away from some thought or feeling that's too painful to accept. And because we run away, we wind up in the wrong bed or over shopping or over drinking or overeating or over consuming. And what the Buddha taught us was that if we sit in meditation, we can contain whatever arises. We don't need to fear our inner life. It may be painful, but if we face it, it will change and pass. If we don't face it, it will hound us like a junkyard dog. So,
yeah, in your message there in your chapter on loss, grief is the price we pay for loving and loss. And the phrase, "and yet." So I've been telling myself that lately, Peter, "and yet." Thank you so much for writing this book. I think people will enjoy it for so many reasons, and there's so much you cover in this book that we didn't have time to talk about today. So let me remind people the title of your book, "Zen in the Vernacular, Things as It Is," and the author is Peter Coyote. Thank you, Peter.
It's out on Amazon. It's out on Barnes & Noble and most every place books are sold. Thank you for a lovely interview, Nancy.
And next, we have a segment we call The Writer's Room, and it features writers from around the North State.
That day, I went up to the flume with Delilah. It was over 100 degrees, and we slipped down the bank into the yellow-brown clay. And the water was cold, and she walked on the water, and I walked beside her that day. Bob Garner.
He Who Smelt It. My daughter and I popped into a new fish store in Chico, which advertised fresh-caught seafood. This is a pretty impressive statement for a business located nearly 200 road miles from the nearest coastal harbor. I asked my daughter what she thought would be good, and after surveying the offerings on the other side of the plexiglass, she quickly pointed to the smelt. Many people are squeamish when it comes to smelt. Too small to fillet, the 5-inch-long fish are sold whole and are generally prepared breaded and fried. I was impressed with both the boldness of my daughter's choice as well as the fact that these fish were from Half Moon Bay, which is about as locally sourced an ocean fish as you can get if you live in Chico. We bought 2 pounds, which was probably close to 50 fish. Ah, but how to cook them? I had a Red Lobster Outback Steakhouse epiphany, and I thought of coconut shrimp. This seemed to me a logical connection. After all, the fish were roughly the same size as jumbo shrimp. They also came from the ocean, and we had some coconut flour in the pantry. It was all coming together perfectly. I imagined how the platter would look, with crispy, honey-colored delicacies laid out side by side in precise formation, the kitchen subtly filled with the combined scents of fresh seafood, coconut, and a dash of lemon thyme for a little bit of mystique. 2 minutes after the fish hit the frying pan, I knew I was in trouble. Tails, heads, and middles were cooking at different rates. I tried to remedy the situation with my preferred kitchen weapon of choice, the spatula, but this just seemed to make things worse. My manipulations caused some fish to jackknife, while others simply fell apart, disintegrating like lumps of sand in a rainstorm. The smelt refused to be flipped, and instead responded to my spatula as if it was a bulldozer, pushing miniature fish parts across the flat steel landscape as bits of spine and fin jutted out at odd angles. Forget the serving platter. I reached for a large bowl into which I deposited the debris. I put caution tape around the frying pan, added some more oil, and tried to cook the remaining 2 dozen fish. Reader, take note. Coconut flour cooked with fish smells like fishy coconut, with a hint of lemon thyme. After opening the windows, I eventually presented my family with a salad plate with 4 mostly honey-colored fish, neatly parallel parked and garnished with a bit of droopy kale. "Didn't you buy 2 pounds?" asked my wife tentatively. I sheepishly revealed the bowl, the contents of which resembled the greasy waste product from a cat food factory. I served the intact fish to my wife and daughters, and then tapped into my inner Dr. Frankenstein and carefully chose a few contents from the bowl to reassemble 3 more fish for myself. I could only manage to eat 2 of them. The 3rd I tried to offer to the dog, who respectfully declined. As I began to take out the ingredients for hamburgers, the sunny voice of my 4-year-old cut across the carnage of my culinary battlefield. "More smelt, please." My name is Jeremy Miller.
For more information on the writers you've just heard, go to mynspr.org and click on the poetry link.
You've been listening to Nancy's Bookshelf, a production of North State Public Radio. You can find this and other episodes of Nancy's Bookshelf on our website, mynspr.org.